From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. In his novel A Happy Marriage, Rafael Iglesias has drawn a portrait of the beginning and the end of a marriage. It's based on his memories of meeting his wife, falling in love, and getting married, and what it was like years later when she died. One reviewer in the Wall Street Journal wrote, "Maybe marriage is the oldest story in the world, but in Mr. Iglesias's tender, funny, rueful telling, the lifelong relationship is the story of life itself." A Happy Marriage comes out in paperback next week. And film critic David Edelstein reviews The Other Guys, the new spoof of cop films co-starring Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg as mismatched detectives. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Rafael Iglesias is the author of A Happy Marriage, an autobiographical novel that comes out next week in paperback. It's a portrait of the beginning and end of a marriage. It alternates between the time the main character falls in love with his wife and years later when, in his early 50s, he watches her slowly die from cancer. Reviewing it in the New York Times, Denisha Smith wrote, quote, "Rafael Iglesias has transformed the story of his life and that of his wife, who died in 2004, into a profound deliberation on the nature of love, marriage, and the process of dying," unquote. Iglesias is the son of writers Jose and Helen Iglesias. Rafael dropped out of high school to finish his first novel, which was published when he was 17. He's made his living writing screenplays, including Dark Water, Les Miserables, Death and the Maiden, and Fearless, which was adapted from his novel of the same name. A Happy Marriage is his first novel in 13 years. Terry interviewed Rafael Iglesias last year when the book was published.
Rafael Iglesias, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to start by just setting up the reading that we've chosen to begin with.
At this point in the novel, Margaret has gone through 2 years and 9 months of treatment for bladder cancer. For the last 6 months of those treatments, she's been considered terminal. Actually, for longer than that, 9 months she's been considered terminal. And she can no longer eat or drink on her own. And so she is being fed intravenously, both for nutrition and hydration, by her husband, Enrique, using a method called TPN. Her mouth dries out frequently, so one of the things he does to relieve her discomfort is get her popsicles, which she can suck on. Her general despair at having nothing left to her life but lying in bed without any energy and being fed all day long and not being able to participate at all in life is the point she's reached. And this is what happens when she speaks to Enrique about her situation. He was silenced by the sight of her despair. Though her tears continued to flow, her voice rang with conviction. "I can't do this. I can't live like this. I can't go on being tethered to a bag for half the day. I can't stand not eating with you and the boys and our friends. I know it sounds so stupid, so trivial, so small, but I can't live like this." He felt the box begin to drip on his jeans. He wanted to put the bars in the freezer because if they melted, he didn't know if he could summon the energy to walk to the supermarket again. But he couldn't run away from this statement. He had known for over a year when her cancer returned in March that she was almost certain to die. Last September, on hearing the news of her second recurrence, and that there were no therapies with a promise of success, Margaret had decided to stop seeking experimental treatments, to try to enjoy whatever time she had left. He had agreed with her decision and felt a guilty relief that at least some of the horrors of the hospital could be skipped. There would be time, perhaps a few months, to commune with their sons, to sleep once more in their summer house on the main coast, to visit with friends somewhere other than waiting rooms. They tried to plan what final things to do, and then on the sixth day she changed her mind. She couldn't give up. To live without hope wasn't life. "I don't want to do a farewell tour," she said. Enrique agreed instantly to this reversal, this time relieved that they wouldn't be passing up a chance for a miracle. In truth, he could find no comfortable place to sit in the company of her illness. He would feel guilt and shame, no matter how he behaved. She was going to die, and he was not. In the undeclared war of marriage, it was an appalling victory.
And that's Rafael Iglesias reading from his new novel, A Happy Marriage. The novel is based on your experiences during your wife's illness and death. Why did you want to write about that, and why write a novel and not a memoir?
I wanted to, first of all, I should say that I didn't write it as a novel to provide any cover for myself. There are a lot of things in the course of the book that Enrique, who's really just a straightforward stand-in for me, a lot of things that he does that are silly, that are cruel, that are weak, and that are foolish, those are all things I actually did. I chose to write it as a novel because I wanted to tell the story of a marriage, and in doing that, I wanted to go back and forth between the first 3 weeks of when Enrique and Margaret meet, which is when he's 21 and she's 24, and the last 3 weeks of her life, which are very, very defined, because since she can no longer eat or drink on her own, by simply stopping taking the intravenous hydration and nutrition, she knows she will die within 2 weeks' time. And she takes some steroids to get some extra energy so that she can say these farewells very deliberately to each member of her family and finally to Enrique. I wanted to alternate back and forth between this confused young man and this 50-year-old man, one of whom is trying to figure out what this young woman means to him, and the 50-year-old man who's trying to figure out how to say goodbye, how to think about his marriage. I wanted you to be very present in both of those marriages, to feel what they feel, to be in their shoes. And in order to do that, I needed to make it a novel and not simply a recollection of events. I needed to compress conversations in some cases. I needed to create real drama in the passages that are 30 years old. And, you know, I don't remember exactly what was said 30 years ago. So I needed to make it into, for lack of a better word, art, and not simply reportage.
You gave the main character's name Margaret, the same name that your wife had. So on some level, you really wanted it to be about her.
Yes. When writing the novel, I called her Margaret, and I intended to change it later. But I used her real name because I really wanted to summon her completely. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that I wrote this novel is that before Margaret ever got ill, I had always wanted to write a novel about a long marriage, especially when I realized in middle age that I had fallen very deeply back in love with my wife in a way that was quite different than the sort of early days of infatuation. And I realized I couldn't write a novel about that because it was a terrible invasion of her privacy, and also because it's very difficult to write about something that's still ongoing, a relationship. After she died, it occurred to me that I could go back to this subject because I would no longer be invading her privacy, and also I could sit down and look at the marriage, which was really what grief was making me do anyway. I therefore kept her as her real name because I really wanted to summon her, exactly her. And then when the book was done, it just felt sort of silly, actually, to change her name.
You know, you, as you said, the book is a comparison between what the young Enrique feels toward the woman who becomes his wife and what he feels when he's in his 50s and she's dying. And early on, he feels such great physical attraction to her. And at the end of her life is taken over by her body's failures. All her body fluids leak. He has to clean them up. He has to give her IV fluids. I mean, her body has failed. It's deteriorated. What's left of her is her spirit, her soul, whatever you want to call it. And I'm wondering how, in writing this book and flipping back and forth between your thoughts about your wife when you were young and you were meeting and your thoughts about her as she was dying, what the meaning of her body meant to you and how it changed over the years. I don't mean that in any graphic kind of way, but just, you know, like the body is something we fall in love with. When we fall in love, we feel physical attraction. Yes. And at the end of her life, you had to look outside of her body to know what it was that you cared about.
Yes, one of the things I really wanted to capture is that in any long relationship, there is this movement, in any long relationship that begins as a romance, there's this movement, if it succeeds, from the, you know, the purely physical lust of the beginnings into a kind of deeper love. She's actually remains quite beautiful to him, as my wife was to me, even while she is dying. Similarly, there are a couple of chapters that interrupt the back and forth from beginning and end in the novel, a chapter when he's fallen completely out of love with her in his mid-20s, and another chapter a couple of chapters later in middle age, which are also very physical chapters. He's a physical being, and also I think human beings tend to express or not express their love physically. So, yes, her physical deterioration and the fact that he loves her just as much when her body is no longer a sexual object to him is, I think, a profound lesson for him. And the loss of her as a companion and as a guide and as a comfort and all of that is much greater in the end than the simple loss of youth. While writing the book, strangely, I sometimes found writing Enrique and Margaret as a young couple even more painful than the passages about dying and death.
Why is that?
Well, because I had to really, I was trying to write it in as present a way as possible, as though you were actually there. So I made a great effort to really recall what it was like to be that young man and to recall her as a young woman. And so I realized all the opportunities that were lost in some ways and just the memory of how much time had passed of so much lost youth. At least when she was ill, we were always very close and communicated very completely. So I guess in a certain way there was more regret about the youth than old age.
In the novel, there are plenty of times when the character has to clean up the mess that her broken body has made. And he has to deal with this mess without being physically disgusted by her presence, by her body, to still love her. And everybody has to do that at some point with a baby or a parent or a spouse or a friend. But I'm wondering if that's something that you found difficult or if it was not difficult to overcome the physical repulsion and still feel what you felt.
You know, one of the funny things about writing the novel is that I was embarrassed by some of the foolish things I had to recount about myself, but in a way I was sometimes embarrassed about this aspect of it as well. I didn't want to come off as seeming noble. As you say, it's not that different than raising children or changing their diapers and so on. The physical taking care of the fluids and all the rest of it is repulsive, of course. There's nothing pleasant about it. And it was depressing. Mostly it was depressing because of the amount of discomfort that she was going through at different times. But I have to say that being able to do something, it made her feel better for Enrique and also for me, was a great relief in lots of ways. So there's, along with the messiness and the exhaustion of doing it and some of the revulsion, there's also a kind of peace to it, a kind of sense of purpose.
Author and screenwriter Rafael Iglesias speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2009 interview with screenwriter and novelist Rafael Iglesias. His novel, A Happy Marriage, comes out in paperback next week. It's based on his own life and alternates between the beginning and the end of his marriage. His wife died in 2004 of bladder cancer. He gave the wife in the novel his own wife's name, Margaret.
During one of the periods in the novel where, you know, Margaret is, I think at this point she's basically in a stupor, and she's being sedated by Ativan. Mm-hmm. And your character, Enrique, says he expected when she woke up that they would start talking in a way they never had, in a way they now must, about their marriage. You're a writer. Your life is words. Did you want to talk about death when your wife, Margaret, was dying, about what she meant to you, all those things? I mean, did you want her life to end like a novel with things tied up, like at the end of a story?
Yes, and I think I did. I think I wanted to be able to, you know, as I realized, while a cancer patient is ill and you're helping them fight the illness, you don't really talk about death. One of the things that was very brave about Margaret's decision to die within a certain set period of time and say goodbye to each person is that unless you do that, unless you say to somebody, this is it, this is the last conversation we're going to have, people are really reluctant to say a real goodbye. Enrique, as and I was in the same situation, is the gatekeeper for those farewells, but he knows that he's the last in line and that he will then get to say his farewell. And it's hard to just say, oh, I miss you, I love you, I'm sorry. You want to say something that expresses more the real gratitude you feel about what the person has done for you over the course of a lifetime. And what's difficult about that goodbye for Enrique is that a lot of what he's grateful for is how tolerant she was of his faults and of some of their the lowest periods in their marriage. So it's a difficult goodbye to construct in a way that's simple and straightforward, and ultimately he can't do it. It's not really possible to summarize a life together. It's part of the reason I wanted to write the novel. I really wanted to bring a reader into the experience of feeling this full passage of two people's lives together.
At what point did your wife decide she wanted to die?
She decided that she wanted to die once she had deteriorated to the point where even the 12 hours of intravenous nutrition was not really sustaining her. She was losing weight daily and she was getting multiple infections. And it was clear that very soon, within a month or two, perhaps three or four at the outside, something would kill her finally, a final infection, a final collapse of an organ. And she knew, as I did from the deaths of other people we'd watched, that if you waited for death that way, you were likely to experience it in a complete morphine coma or in some completely unconscious state. She couldn't, as is said in the novel, she couldn't control the disease, so in the end she wanted to control her farewell. She wanted to be able to have some sense of what the last hours of her life were going to be like. She wanted to have a sense of what her funeral was going to be like. She wanted to really say goodbye to her children and to her family and to her friends. So she decided at that point to simply stop the artificial hydration and nutrition she was receiving, which meant that within 2 weeks, really at the outside, she would die. And she was supplemented with some steroids, so she'd really have energy for all these big farewells.
So did you and she work on a plan for that remaining time?
We worked on who were the people she absolutely wanted to see face to face. And we worked on me getting her a plot in a graveyard she admired very much, Greenwood in Brooklyn, and in arranging who would be at the, you know, where the funeral would be held. She wanted to hold it at a 19th century synagogue in the Lower East Side in New York. And we pretty much figured out everything that we could, the final dinner she would have with friends, the last meetings with her family, and pretty much everything.
She was going to have a dinner even though her body couldn't hold food anymore?
Well, at that point, as had been true for a number of months, she had a tube emptying her stomach so that she could eat things. She wouldn't be able to get any nutritional value out of them. They would simply pass directly from her stomach into a bag that then I would empty.
Now
so
you,
she could have the taste. I mean, it was the one saving grace of the terrible way she was dying. She could taste things and enjoy the taste. It just didn't do her any good.
You mentioned that she wanted to choose where she would be buried, and this is a source of real tension in the book because her parents, in the book, Margaret's parents want her to be buried in the family plot, and they want the funeral to be held in a place that they know with their rabbi. And Margaret wants to be buried in a different cemetery and with a rabbi who she likes. And it kind of reflects a lifelong sensibility difference between Margaret and her family. But this is like the final moments of her life. And it's such a kind of thorny kind of disagreement to have at the end of life with your parents about, I mean, they could be really insulted. Oh, she doesn't want to be buried with us. She doesn't want to be buried in our plot. Can you talk a little bit about negotiating that in real life?
Yes. I mean, there was a tension between Margaret and her family, and especially her mother, always about control of all sorts of things and all sorts of events. And that persisted even in the end. One of the things that you learn when someone dies very consciously is that it's not as though everyone behaves very, very differently than they have their whole lives. The same issues that remain between people always remain. It's one of the things that I wanted to emphasize in the novel and why I alternate the time periods the way I do. I wanted to show that what's easy between people always remains easy, And what's difficult always remains difficult, even if they create compromises and ways of managing those differences. They never really go away. So at the end, Margaret's differences with her mother about how every family event should be controlled pop up again, because of course her parents naturally assume that they will do it with their rabbi and in their temple, and that she'll be buried in the family plot. But Margaret really wanted to control those things, even though she wasn't going to be there. She wanted her death and her funeral to reflect her tastes and her not very different values, but slightly different values. And she also simply wanted, on just the most human level, to control it herself and not have it be controlled by others. The difficulty for Enrique is that he's sort of the Secretary of State of this negotiation and has to be a real intermediary, because Margaret doesn't feel up to having an argument about it. And I go into it in such detail partly because, and this is really something that is my strongest feeling about writing about the course of a long relationship, is that these sorts of issues between people, which are often comic and seem silly, really are what make relationships change and grow over time, how they're managed. That Margaret, at the end of her life, got her parents to accept that she wanted things done her way was, in a way, a kind of peace and reconciliation for both of them in the end. And similar things happen throughout the novel between her and her husband, her and her children, in which the very brave way that she faces the end of her life allows people to bring to a certain kind of emotional close issues that existed for them during their entire relationship.
Rafael Iglesias speaking to Terry Gross in 2009. We'll have more of their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. From Pabst Brewing, proud supporter of local artists nationwide and of the NPR Live in Concert series, online at PabstBlueRibbon.com. And from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at AngiesList.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, writer Rafael Iglesias talks about being the son of two writers and dropping out of high school to write his first novel, which was published when he was 17. We'll also talk more about the death of his wife, which inspired his novel, A Happy Marriage. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new comedy action film, The Other Guys. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's 2009 interview with novelist and screenwriter Rafael Iglesias. His novel, A Happy Marriage, comes out in paperback next week. It's based on the beginning and end of his own marriage. His wife died of bladder cancer in 2004.
Was it important for you to be with her at her final moments? And I ask that in a way because when you have someone you love who's dying and you want to be with them in their final moments, you don't really know when those final moments are going to be. And so, like, you're afraid to leave the bedside. If they're at the hospital, you're afraid to go home. And I was just wondering how you handled that.
In real life, After Margaret lost consciousness and was comatose, I simply stayed beside her all the time. And I was very frightened when I needed to go take a shower or, in fact, at the end of the novel, he decides to take a shower because he thinks she's in a coma and almost misses an important moment between them. It's a very difficult thing to handle, and you need really family and hospice support to make it possible to really be there as much as possible. I felt there was a tremendous anxiety in my case about being there with my wife all the way till the end, and I give the same feeling to Enrique, partly because I was not there for all of the final moments of my father, who died from prostate cancer in 1995. And I left it up to the hospital, the hospice, to take care of him for long stretches of time. And so I wasn't actually there at the moment of his death. And I always lived to regret it. Even if it's just an abstract form of comfort, the notion that I was actually there at the moment that her life ended made me feel that it was a less sad death. That's probably just an illusion, but it's a very strong one, I guess, that we all feel.
How did you make the decision when your father was dying to not be there?
My wife, Margaret, actually didn't think I should be there the whole time, that it was too difficult a thing to just maintain a vigil like that. And I think it was one of the lessons of her illness that she realized she and I and lots of people had taken an attitude toward illness that was not really helpful. The single most comforting to her thing to her during her treatments and her illness was my presence. She just liked me to be there, even if I couldn't be particularly helpful. And I think we both learned from that, that strange as it may seem, it is important to be there as much as you can. It's important not just to the person who's dying, but it's important to you later. It's important to feel that, you know, you've completed the relationship, that you did everything you could.
And you felt even when she was in a coma that she could sense your presence?
I did and I didn't. I went back and forth about it. Sometimes I was sure of it, and sometimes I felt, no, it's just an empty shell of a person. It's not her. I was never really sure, and I don't like to make assertions about it. It's more, I think, important to me that I be there because I feel that way there's no possibility of error.
Right. Your character describes himself as a godless man. And my guess is that you would describe yourself that way, too. And your character says that there were lots of friends and extended family that he didn't really feel he could turn to for comfort. And so I was just kind of wondering, like, without a sense of God and without having friends who you felt you could really turn to for comfort at that time, was there something that you could turn to?
I turned to the people whom I really loved. My sons were comfort to me, but they were in such pain that I couldn't really use them for comfort and didn't think that was appropriate. There were friends, and my sister was of enormous comfort to me. Margaret's closest friend was of great comfort to me as well. I didn't feel that I could be comforted, though, for what was actually happening, which is that a person I loved very much was dying and I couldn't really stop it or manage it in a way that made it not be what it was. I did with Margaret go to temple once a week while she was ill. At the moment she died, I said the Hebrew prayer that you're supposed to say when a Jew dies, and to tell God that that she's coming. I didn't find any of that comforting, though. I did it in order to honor her religion, which was of comfort to her. What was comforting to me in the end was that I took care of her as well as I could. That was the most comforting thing to me.
There's a moment where Enrique, your main character, thinks death, the destroyer of chit-chat. Did you feel that way about this book, that there was really no room for inessential stuff here or for the trivial?
No, I think the book actually is loaded with a certain amount of trivialities.
But the trivialities are there for a reason.
They're there for a reason, yeah. No, that's true, yeah. No, they are. I think that, you know, death is the engine of the narrative because it forces Enrique and the reader to look at every aspect of what's going on between the couple, even when they're young and death is not in the room with them, to look at it in the framework of the notion that what we do with each other has a time limit and that it doesn't recur. That's part of what I meant about it being painful writing them when young. That youth is gone, even though they can be happy and there can be a mature love later. Well, the pleasures of that youth disappear and is in itself a kind of dying. It's partly why I went back and forth in the two times. I wanted to sort of contrast these two mysteries, falling in love and falling and death, which are both mysterious to us. But I guess I felt that what makes illness and death interesting is that it strips away from people all the things that we tend to think are more important than they really are. It's one of the reasons why I went back to the conflict over how she was going to be buried and all of that. You have to decide now, since this is the end, what is really finally important to you, and that's what makes it clear to you what a triviality is and what isn't.
One more question about the novel. Were there things you felt that you would only be able to understand about your wife, your relationship, and her death if you wrote about it?
Yes. I really wanted to examine what made our marriage work, because in some ways it was a mystery to me, and that's why I framed the book the way I did. It's a mystery to Enrique as she's dying, exactly what it is that he's losing. And so writing the book was a way of my examining, several years after my wife's death, what the marriage really was and what it meant to me and what it consisted of in its worst moments and in its best moments. I really wanted to understand why these relationships are important to us, whether they work wonderfully or whether they work smoothly or not. And so writing it became for me a real bringing back to life of the heart of the marriage. And in that way, I think I was finally able to say goodbye to it.
You wouldn't have felt comfortable, you've said, writing about your wife and your marriage when she was alive. Did you still feel protective of her when she was dead? Or are there things that you still weren't comfortable writing about? Or did you think it no longer mattered?
No, I wrote about everything, including things that I'm sure would have enraged her. I didn't feel that there was any point in doing the book unless I was going to be as honest as I could possibly be about both of us.
And how come that didn't bother you? Knowing that some of the things you said would enrage her. And I'll preface this by saying you come from a family of writers, so...
Right. I mean, it is true that if you come from a family of writers, you understand that there is always an assassin in the family. I don't really know any other way of doing the writing, so I didn't feel I had any choice. And there were times when I considered just not publishing the book or not showing it to anyone. But I also knew that that I felt that so acutely that it was so dangerous was also a sign that I was writing it correctly.
Had your parents and their novels written characters that you knew were based on you that you found troubling?
Actually, even when someone writes you in a novel flatteringly, the truth is it's always troubling because it's odd to be a minor character in someone else's life since we're always the major character in our lives.
Oh, that's so interesting the way you put it.
So it's always disturbing.
Was that upsetting to see that in your parents' work you were a minor character?
It was very strange, always disturbing, and I believe, although people will say otherwise, that it's always disturbing to people to appear in someone's book. It's just, it offends the natural narcissism of every individual.
Author and screenwriter Rafael Iglesias speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2009 interview with screenwriter and novelist Rafael Iglesias. His novel, A Happy Marriage, comes out in paperback next week. It's based on his own life and alternates between the beginning and the end of his marriage. His wife died in 2004 of bladder cancer.
Like Enrique, the main character in your book, you published your first, well, you wrote your first novel when you were 16. Was that one published?
Yes, I wrote it when I was 16. When it came out, I was 17 years old.
God, that's amazing. How do you get a novel published when you're that young? Who did you know? Who did you go to?
Well, my parents, who were both born to very poor working-class families, had struggled most of their lives to become writers. My father finally got his first novel published when he was 43. My mother...
This is Jose Iglesias and Helen Iglesias.
That's right, Jose and Helen Iglesias. And Helen, my mom, published her first novel actually when she was 56, a few months after I published my first novel. So what happened while I was a child was that I watched these two people. My father for a long time worked at a pharmaceutical company, and my mother was a housewife, as far as I knew, until I was 8 or 9. Suddenly, both changed quite dramatically. My mother became the back-of-the-book editor of The Nation magazine when I was 10 or 11. My father quit his job and started publishing books and writing for the Sunday Times magazine and publishing short stories in The New Yorker. So while I was 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, I watched them become writers. And it seemed to me that anyone could become a writer since they were just an ordinary couple. So when I got upset about life and so on, I just wrote a novel. When I finished it, I got into some very big fights with my parents over what to do about it. I wanted to quit high school and just be a novelist. They naturally thought I should finish my education. But when they read the novel, they both thought it was quite extraordinary. So they gave it to their agent, who had some quibbles about it, and they gave it to another friend who was an editor, and she gave it to an editor at Doubleday who bought it right away. It may sound like that was all influence, but it really wasn't. It was, after all, whatever the merits or lack of merits of the novel, it was an interesting novel for a publisher to publish, since there weren't that many books by 16-year-olds.
Give us like the 3-sentence version of what the book was about.
Like this novel, it was an incredibly straightforward autobiographical novel about my last year at a private school in Manhattan. I went to Horace Mann. And about a kid who was exactly like me, who, in a very turbulent time, 1968, begins to cut school, believing that, you know, bourgeois America is valueless and it's all going to come crashing down. And he cuts school, and it's really about what it's like to be an unhappy adolescent. It's a very, you know, honest and straightforward account of it, and that's what people found interesting. It was written almost without any perspective on being an adolescent. It's because it's being written by an adolescent. And so it had a quality, I guess, an urgency and an immediacy that people found very powerful.
Did it sell any copies?
It sold, I think, about 3 editions or so.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, and actually, I made about $11,000 off it in my apartment in those days. Yeah, my apartment in those days only cost 68 bucks a month, so I lived off of it for 3 years.
That's amazing. Yeah. Now, you not only published a novel when you were 17, you basically dropped out of high school and left your family when you were 16. And
I moved in with an older woman. She was 25.
A girlfriend?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay, so
lived with her for 3 years.
This is a very rebellious thing to do. Your parents obviously did not want you to do any of this. But your parents were rebellious people, too. Your father had been... the film critic for the Daily Worker, the communist publication. Who even knew they had a film critic?
Yes, they did. You know, in 1948 to 1950, actually, that was because it was not quite so underground. He was kind of well known as their film critic.
Yeah, and your
yes, both my parents were members of the Communist Party in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. They told me before they died, that when the Stalin doctor trials came out, they wanted to leave the party. But it was the McCarthy period then, and they thought it would be cowardly if they did. So they stayed in the party till about 59, 60, when they thought it was safe to leave. But by then, my father had fallen in love with the Cuban Revolution. He was a Cuban-American who grew up in a cigar-making community in Tampa, Florida, Ybor City. And it, unlike the community in Miami that left after Castro's revolution, were very pro-Fidel. So my father had his sort of idealism of his youth reawakened by Castro's revolution. And for a good 5 or 6 years, he was a big supporter of it. So, yes, I was raised by odd parents. My father once said to me in perfect seriousness, this is the sort of guy he was, that there were only 2 great things to be in life, only 2 worthwhile things to be in life, a revolutionary or an artist. And so I was very rebellious, and I gave my parents a lot of grief, but I was really following the principles of what they were saying about the world.
Yeah, I was wondering, like, how do you rebel against parents who are so rebellious? and how do they act when their son rebels against them?
It turns out to be incredibly easy. Parents, even when they think they want revolutionaries, really don't, and they certainly don't want high school dropouts. they were very angry at me, actually.
So what did they try to do to bring you back in the fold?
Yelled and, threw fits and temper tantrums and pleaded with me and all sorts of things. My parents were odd in this respect, though. Once I showed them the manuscript of my novel, all the fighting ended. They thought it was the work of a real writer, and they understood then that if that's what I wanted to do, it was fine. They just wanted me to go to college or in some way create something to fall back on. But the fighting and the argument stopped once they no longer worried that I was cutting school to take drugs and just hang out. As long as they understood that I was doing something they respected, then they calmed down about that aspect of it. They were still very, very worried as to how I would make a living, and they were correct to worry about that.
Did you ever go back to school?
No, I didn't, and I regret it quite a bit. There were a couple of colleges, once my novel came out and was highly praised, that, of course, were willing to admit me without a high school diploma, and I should have gone. I missed out on a lot. I missed out on really having a peer group, and I missed out also on having 4 years in which I wasn't under enormous pressure. As a published writer, I had to get another contract, publish another book, be reviewed, and those were pressures that are pretty tough to handle even for someone in their 20s, but for someone who was 17, it was overwhelming.
Yeah, you mentioning pressures. I read that for one of your novels, and I don't know which one this was, that your publisher was getting restless, they wanted the manuscript, and you gave back the advance. You had to be feeling a lot of anxiety to give back the advance.
Yes. yes, that actually led to my first film being made, because partly to resolve that conflict, I wrote an adaptation on spec of it, and then it got made as a film, and the book was published the way I wanted.
This was Fearless?
Fearless, yeah, back in 1993.
Was that Jeff Bridges in that?
Yes, Jeff Bridges and Rosie Perez, and Peter Weir directed it beautifully. But yes, I had a very tumultuous several decades as a writer, partly as a consequence, to tell you the truth, of my parents' politics and their sort of combative attitude toward the world. It's something that I had to sort of shed slowly and painfully over the years. And in a way, it's something I admire about my parents and their generation, the notion that you could change the world with your writing and that what you're doing with your writing is terribly important and of great value to the world. But it's also kind of crippling if what you're just trying to do is get better at it and to sort of fully express the world as you see it.
Rafael Iglesias, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Screenwriter and author Rafael Iglesias speaking to Terry Gross in 2009. His latest novel, A Happy Marriage, comes out next week in paperback. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new Will Ferrell comedy, The Other Guys. This is Fresh Air. Will Ferrell stars in The Other Guys, a new comedy directed and co-written by his longtime collaborator, Adam McKay. It's a spoof of the buddy action cop movie and co-stars Mark Wahlberg as his mismatched partner. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
At capturing the poetry of male obliviousness, Will Ferrell has no peer. Consider his preening Ron Burgundy in Anchorman, his swaggering yet befuddled racer Ricky Bobby in Talladega Nights, his golden-locked skater Chaz Michael Michaels in Blades of Glory, child men who put on macho airs and look more and more like great big babies. In his one-man show, You're Welcome, America, Ferrell portrays George W. Bush as an over-entitled rich boy posing haplessly as a Texas cowboy. Best of all is his infantile 39-year-old Brennan Huff in Step Brothers, which is, for my money, the great American slapstick comedy of the last decade. Along with his director and co-writer, Adam McKay, Ferrell created an environment on set in which a lot of gifted, unself-censoring actors and actresses had license to say and do anything, take after take. The upshot was gorgeously controlled pandemonium. The latest Ferrell-McKay collaboration is The Other Guys, a buddy cop comedy, and the bad news is that it isn't in the league of their last few. The good news is that even a second-tier Ferrell-McKay comedy is better than almost anything at the movies. Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg play New York detectives Alan Gamble and Terry Hoyts, both in the shadow of hot dog cops played by Samuel L. Jackson and Dwayne Johnson. The movie opens with Jackson and Johnson on a high-speed chase, jumping in and out of cars and trucks while blowing stuff up and trading one-liners. The problem is there's no visual wit, just expensive mayhem. It looks too much like the action films it's parodying. The Other Guys gets better when Jackson and Johnson leave the picture, on a high, and Gamble and Hoyts try to fill their shoes. Ferrell's Gamble has tight curly hair and wire-rimmed specs and is a study in wonkish repression. He's an accountant by training. He never wants to leave his desk. On the other hand, Wahlberg's Hoyts has been confined to his desk after shooting a major sports figure under circumstances I won't spoil. Hoyts wears black leather sports jackets and impugns Gamble's masculinity, finally resorting to animal metaphors.
I don't like you. I think you're a fake cop. If we were in the wild, I would attack you. If I were a lion and you were a tuna, I would swim out in the middle of the ocean and eat you!
Okay, first off, a lion swimming in the ocean? Lions don't like water. If you'd placed it near a river or some sort of fresh water source, that makes sense. But you find yourself in the ocean, 20-foot waves, I'm assuming it's off the coast of South Africa, coming up against a full-grown 800-pound tuna with his 20 or 30 friends, you lose that battle. You lose that battle 9 times out of 10. Did that go the way you thought it was going to go? Nope. Ah!
Ah! That's coffee being dumped all over Ferrell's shirt. The case the pair stumbles into has something to do with Steve Coogan as a high-risk money man who's billions in the red, and Anne Heche, who's seriously underused, as the head of a multinational conglomerate at risk of collapse. The plotting is loose, but the Wall Street setting isn't arbitrary. Over the closing credits are graphs and captions, the ratio of CEO salaries to workers' salaries over the last few decades, the amount of bonus money given to executives at companies taking bailouts. I wish, instead of another buddy cop movie, they'd made a comedy about a money manager or broker. What saves The Other Guys is that Ferrell and McKay let no scene go until they've turned its apparent premise inside out. The sheer accumulation of absurdities is dizzying. Ferrell's Gamble turns out to have a complicated backstory. He's married to a smoking hot doctor played by Eva Mendes. He's trying to be a wonk to keep the violent pimp inside him at bay. Opposite Ferrell, Mark Wahlberg doesn't so much send up his own peculiar combination of thuggishness and sweetness as play it absolutely straight, no winking. And he's hilarious. I look back over my notes on the movie and find myself choking with laughter. The Prius, Dirty Mike and his homeless orgies, Good Cop, Bad Cop, Jersey Boys, Sarcastic Ballet, Christine. You don't know what I'm talking about, but if you see the other guys, those words will have you doubled over too. What makes Will Ferrell such a treasure is that for all the lowbrow gags, he doesn't satirize stupidity. He satirizes fear, the lengths to which men will go to keep from looking vulnerable. I'm excited by what might come down the road. A great business comedy? A great black comedy of war, like Duck Soup? Aim high, Will, and get low.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hersfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working through its Pew Health Group to help families gain access to safe, affordable financial products at pewtrusts.org. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Jonathan Eich takes us back to the Roaring Twenties in Chicago, when cops and judges were on the take, bootleggers were mowing each other down, and Al Capone bragged to reporters about his underworld clout. He made his reputation the day he approached a rival in broad daylight.
Says hello, puts the gun to his cheek, fires six times, and holds him on the barstool as he keeps firing.
What you didn't know about Al Capone. Join us.